My name is Ralph, and I'm an alcoholic. I really want to thank this group for asking me to come out again and get an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. You know, and I get the opportunity to do that from time to time, and I always try to mind my manners, let you guys know Mama raised me right. So I thank the group at the beginning, but for this group in particular, I also want to thank you guys for the hospitality, and I want to thank you for the welcome, and I want to thank you for being one of the groups in Alcoholics Anonymous that really represents and demonstrates what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. A lot of members of this group, if you come here all the time and you don't get the opportunity to do traveling and go to other groups, you may take for granted what's going on here. But when people get up here and talk about the importance of commitments and people demonstrate it, when people make the speaker feel as welcome as you guys do, when people stand at the door and greet people coming in, you know, you don't know because it's what you have already. It's like when you live in your house, you don't know how good it makes a guest feel and how welcome you feel. And you know, and let me take that term back, because I feel like when I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, anywhere I go, I ain't a guest, I'm at home. And you guys make me feel that way even more. So I want to thank this group. I've been here a couple of times, and I really, really, really like the vibe that's in this room. You know, so let's see where we go tonight. You know, and before we go any further, I want to take this opportunity to welcome our new friends, at least those of you who identified as being new. I want to welcome you, Catalina, welcome you, John, Ryan, Roger, Rhonda, a lot of R's, Ralph, some with the Mars, huh? You know, but I want to welcome my new friends to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to let you guys know, like I know, if you be the alcoholic of Ralph's variety, this is probably the best step you can take from the cradle to the grave. And I don't say that because I'm tonight's speaker. I don't say that because I'm at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying that because it's what we say when we get behind a podium. I say that because this program and these 12 steps and this power you guys introduced me to has been working in my life like nothing I had discovered up until the time I reached these doors. I get the chance to go out and I get the opportunity to share. And like a lot of you guys in here, I've been doing this a couple of 24 hours, and the temptation is to say to you tonight, I'm not going to share a long drunkalogue. Everybody knows how to drink. But like some of our new friends that's sitting out there tonight, I remember being new to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember sitting in the meeting, sitting in the middle of the group. Guy was standing up in front of the group that night, somewhat like I am tonight. He was dressed pretty nice, and his hair was combed, and his eyes were bright, and he was stringing sentences together real well. And I remember thinking to myself that night, this cat don't know where I've been. He ain't felt what I've felt, and he ain't done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? You know. So I need to let you know that the man that's standing in front of you tonight, it's not the same one that stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous October the 11th, 1986. I weighed about 40 pounds less than I weigh right now. My hair was sticking up all over my head that October in 86. You could probably smell me all the way out where the cars are parked. And those were things that you could see and you could touch and you could smell. And a lot of other things were happening with Ralph that October the 11th. You know, I had lost a couple of jobs in those last 2 years. I lost my home, lost my marriage, lost my family, lost my self-respect, lost the trust of anybody who would come close to me, and I lost a couple of other things most of us lose by the time we reach a room like this. I lost the power of choice over whether or not I'd be chasing it tonight, and I had stopped caring about it. And the second part scared me way more than the first part, because I wasn't raised to be what I had become, you know. I'm going to do like my cousin did, and I want to thank him for coming up here and sharing his experience, strength, and hope tonight, you know, and giving it up before I got a chance. And the cool thing about it, somebody bring me back, too, because I go off somewhere. So bring me back where we were, right? Help me, you know. I had them senior moments. But I want to thank my cousin for coming up here tonight and giving it up like that and trudging this road. And more important, thank him for being in my life these last 4 years. He's celebrating a birthday right now, you know, and it's his fourth birthday. And he really liked running his mouth about this program of recovery. So I could think of no better gift than share him with you guys tonight. So I want to thank you, Melvin, for sharing. You know, but so bring me back, you know. Somebody bring me back. So anyway, Oh, I'm going to share, like he did, in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. Because somebody sitting out there like Ralph was, thinking to themselves, if you hear what it is that we're going to go through tonight, you might be driven to think to yourself, damn, I used to do that. Man, I used to feel like that. Shit. I used to act just like that. Or more important than all them, man, if he can do this, I can do this too. I too want to have this thing. And that's what the program Alcoholics Anonymous is really about. Each one teach one. You know, I grew up in South Central L.A., hard to watch. You know, I come from a large family, six boys in my family. I have five brothers. Grew up in a little two-bedroom apartment. You know, moms and pops stayed in one bedroom. The six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other bedroom. Earliest memory of pops was he was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be like him. Now, my father wasn't violent, and my father wasn't abusive. My father was absentee drunk. And every other Friday, like clockwork, you knew he wasn't going to show up at the house. And it'll be a little boy in the neighborhood who felt it was his duty to come tell my family how my old man had showed his ass the previous Friday or Saturday night up at the pool hall, right? And I would feel ashamed, and I would feel embarrassed. And those are feelings I'm familiar with from a real early age. Oh, my, I could remember some Saturday mornings, man. Moms would be in their bedroom, and she'd be sweeping up under the bed, and you could hear the ripple bottles clinking together. And she got them out from under the bed and put them in a brown bag and took them outside because she wasn't having that ice and put them in the big trash can. And I remember on those mornings, man, I'd be looking at my father if he was home thinking to myself, I ain't going to be like him. I can't stand it. He seemed weak. He wouldn't handle his business. You know, he was not somebody I was proud of and I wanted to grow up and be like. Said, I'm not going to be like this. He got put out the crib when I was 7 or 8 years old. Me and my brothers thought he looked good going, and my mom proceeded to raise six boys by herself. I came up at a time when what I thought an ideal family should be was defined by the TV programs of the time. Maybe kids still do that today. I wouldn't know what programs they're looking at. But when we were coming up, what showed you what an ideal family should be? If you came up in the year I came up, Donna Reed, Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, My Three Sons, Leave It to Beaver, right? I need to let y'all know that wasn't jumping off in my house, you know. When you're grown, you get something that's called perspective, and perspective works like this. You have a mom that raised six boys by herself. She did not have a high school education, and she was on welfare, and she was determined not to settle for that. So you got a mom that's raising these six boys. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you're grown, you look back on your life, and you say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed for her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old and you bring in a couple of partners home on a Wednesday afternoon and you hit the front door and mom's is in the living room with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed because Harriet wasn't ever rolling like that. And you start bringing, you know, you start bringing partners home from school with you. And you retreat into that fantasy world. And if your name is Ralph, you retreat and you start living in that prison that I've lived in so much of my life. It's the prison I lived in so much then. It's the biggest prison I ever lived in, and it's the prison I sometime live in today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion around. I wine you. I'll dine you. I'll woo you. I'll con you. I'll bully you. I'll manipulate you. I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. You know. Right about now, somebody's getting this, what's going on right here, a little bit twisted. Let me throw the disclaimer out right now. You know, because somebody in here is thinking to themselves, this guy might be all right. Speaking, looking around the room, he making eye contact, whatever. Don't let that fool you. I'm looking for the person whose attention is drifting, look like you going to sleep. I'm going to work on your ass. You'll like me before this is over with, right? Yeah. Trapped in what I think you think about me. And to our new friends, you know, you'll hear a lot of things shared from podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and there are a lot of common themes. We say listen for the similarities. And one of the common themes that you'll hear from a lot of our members is, I just never felt like I fit in growing up. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I ain't never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I accomplished a lot of things. Like I shared with you guys real briefly, I had a, and a lot of what I'll share in my story, especially any of the parts that sound as if they're noteworthy and achievements, because I had a lot growing up. Trust me, they would do no design. A lot of what I did wasn't out of no virtue and wasn't because I was a nice guy and wasn't because I was a good guy. I was scared of my mama. And my mama didn't play. My mama whooped a lot of ass, and she did. She was an old Southern Baptist sister that was raising six boys by herself. And in spite of the fact that I grew up in the heart of Watts, like Bush said, I was a boy with big goals and big dreams and big ambitions from an early age in life. You know, I had the kind of mother that marched her boys up to church, up the street to church every Sunday morning. You know, and I would see cats playing football and running track. I get shit twisted still, and I always have. I was the kind of kid that would grow up, and I would see the little boys and girls who is 10:30 at night. You know, they might be 5, 6 years old, and they still outside playing unsupervised. And I thought to myself, ooh, they got cool mamas. You know, right. And I used to resent my mama because she was a good mother. No, your ass going to be in the house with a bath, homework done, in the bed. You know, but, ooh, I wanted them cool mamas that let their kids run wild, you know. And that's the way I grew up. I would be resentful going to church and shit. But, man, moms didn't play. Anyway, getting to my story. This is Ralph. Every one of you guys had me in your school. You know, me growing up, I was a straight-A student. I was always class president or student body president. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all stuff. And on the outside, I had a lot of things that seemed like it should have made me feel all right with myself. I had a lot of friends. But on the inside, I have always felt from an early age and even that if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. I always felt that way. I was smart. I was teacher's pet. I was straight A student. Would have traded it all in a heartbeat if I just could have been cool. Because the cats who was cool, man, was shooting dice in the bathroom. They were smoking cigarettes. They knew how to cuss. And what they really had, they had conversation for girls. They wasn't scared of girls, man. And that just blew me away. Because I have always been terrified of y'all. Big part of Ralph's story. Always been terrified of y'all. Snapshot of Ralph, junior high school. We used to have a dance on Friday nights at my junior high school. Right about now, somebody thinking to themselves, because it's some smart guy in the audience, right? And he thinking to himself right now, what the hell does this have to do with drinking? Stay with me a minute. You know, but I'm a shy guy. I'm introverted, and I'm in junior high school. We would have a dance on Friday nights. Two kind of guys came to the dance. One group of guys stood at the gate taking quarters from cats, right? It cost a quarter to get in. Second group of guys brought an extra quarter with them. I was in that second group, right? So I'm coming to the dance, then paid somebody else to get in too, you know. And I get in the dance, and I'd be in that dance, man, and I'd be on the wall because I was scared of girls, right? And I'd be thinking to myself, I'd be finding the finest girl in the room, right? And I'm scoping her, and I'm looking, leaning on my spot on the wall, thinking to myself, yeah, I'm going to dance with her next week. And I would go through that routine all the time. Right? Fantasy. Reality of how Ralph really got his first dance. I'm on the wall. That part is true. I'm looking around the room. That part's true. I'm not looking for the finest girl. I'm looking for the squarest guy, right? Somebody with bigger glasses on than me. And if he asked a girl to dance with him, and she did, soon as the record was over, I'd rush. I'd say, shit, if she danced with him, she'll dance with anybody. You know, and that's my M.O. I am so afraid of rejection that I won't ask a question unless I already know the answer is going to be yes. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous describes me in a lot of places. And there's a line in there that talks about me. It says, fear. We think it ought to be classed with stealing. And when I heard that the first time, it just hit me where I live. Because I robbed myself of more opportunities than anything out of fear. You know, so that's the way I'm rolling, right? I grow up, I get out of junior high school, I get to high school, still scared of girls. But I get me a girlfriend now. I'm 16 years old, you know, and I get a little girlfriend at 16. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing as the rest of you guys with a girlfriend at 16. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 meant this. I ran with a group of dudes that went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. After a suitable amount of time had passed, I told my other boy, I want to go with her. He went and asked her, told her, yeah, Ralph want to go with you. He came back and told me, she said yes. Now I got a girlfriend, right? But I don't know what to do with her because I don't know what to do with girls, right? And this girl is officially my girlfriend. She has stated it on the record. People know it. She's claiming me is all in the open. And I would call that girl man back then. And in those days, you had them old rotary phones. And when that number went around and it would come back around, fear would set in. Because when she answered the phone, I knew what was going to have to happen. Your ass going to have to talk. It's the telephone. You going to have to talk, right? And I didn't have no conversation. I just hang up the phone. Click. This my girlfriend, right? And I'm hanging up on her, right? 16 years old girlfriend. We go out this particular night. Older partner of mine. He got it. He's dating my cousin. But your sister. You know, dating my cousin at that time. And me and her used to say we were twins. We were born 3 weeks apart. And everybody thought Ralph White and Carol White were twins. You know, anyway, that's another story in and of itself. But this guy is dating my cousin, right? And so I'm in the back seat with my girl. Him and my cousin are in the front seat. We go on a double date to the drive-in movie. Plastic cup of rum and coke came to the back seat this particular night. And I drank that rum and coke down, and it went down real warm and seemed like it rushed back to the top of my brain. And all of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. His mouth started saying things it had never said, you know. And I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about me in a lot of places, and it starts talking about me in the front. Doctor's opinion, lying in there like this. Men and women like Ralph drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. First time I saw that, I'm like, yeah, that's me. I'm like my cousin. No, taste of it, no, I could do without the taste, but I like what it did. I like what it did. I'm not overnight alcoholic. That's not my story. A lot of people, first time they drank, they got drunk, they threw up, they blacked out, all that. That's not my story. I understand when we talk about this disease being progressive in nature, because that's how it showed itself in my experience. And the way that it worked for me was this. I started drinking back then in the 11th grade, and I only drank to go to them parties the youngsters went to, drinking what youngsters was drinking. You know, Tyrolia, Annie Green Spring, Boone Farm, you know, what we was drinking. And I would do it to go to them old garage parties, man, and I'd get up in there, and I'd be dancing. And, man, alcohol did what it was supposed to do for me. It gave me the courage, man. I started dancing. I'd even be slow dancing and grinding in the corner. I was like, ooh, yeah, I like what this alcohol does. You know, and my drinking stayed that way for a long time. I graduated from high school in 1971, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. In 1971, my drinking was still just to go to parties. But by the end of 71, I started drinking not only to go to parties, but it has crept up to during the daytime now to get ready for the party. By 1972, I'm drinking not only to go to parties, but now I'm drinking. I'm drinking during the week, and I done added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm smoking, I'm getting loaded on a daily basis, and you couldn't have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that that worked for me was this. The way that I'm getting loaded, ain't that the way everybody do it? Everybody I knew did. Why would you be young with a bright future? With a little bit of money, I was getting financial aid. Didn't chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? We didn't have nothing to discuss. You know, in the year that I am so glad I came up at the time I came up. I'm serious, because I had a lot of good times. You know, I had a lot of good times, and I had some good get loads. Because, man, now, youngsters, I feel so bad. 2002, you got to worry about sexually transmitted diseases. You got to worry about AIDS. You got to worry about all this old bullshit. Man, when I was coming up back then, early 70s, go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. Ain't wasting time with nothing. What's your sign? Hell no, no, you know. And that's the way that I was living, man. And I can't tell you how it happened. And somehow I made it through school. And in 1976, I started working as a counselor for LA City Schools. And even though I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to start acquiring and accumulating what normal people acquire, I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life. And this is when alcohol was working. You know, I would get up and I'm the kind of brother that I would buy a car. Matter of fact, I did this three times. Buy a car, make exactly three car payments, then come find it. Just come find this shit. You know, you gave me credit or well, you know, and I did that three different times. You know, kind of brother that never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. Zero. No problem balance in my bank book. I stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. And this is when it was working. A couple of baffling features about the disease that I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are real clear to me in the rearview mirror of experience were not at all clear to me when it was happening. You know, I could remember now, looking back, I see people and I see signs. Bill calls it ominous warnings, you know. And you know how you see some of your people, some of your boys be going down slow, and you say, if I get like his ass, I quit. Ooh, if I ever got like that, I would just stop, right? Kind of remind me, because even in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes I like to play the regret game. The regret game goes something like, if I only knew back in 1975 what I know now, I never would have took that for, yeah, right. You know, it remind me of this story that I like to tell from time to time about a little boy named Johnny. Johnny had a habit that his father frowned on. He used to like to play with himself. Father goes to work one day, comes home early, gets home, and sure enough, little Johnny's bedroom door is closed. Dad goes and opens the door without knocking. Little Johnny standing in the bedroom masturbating. His father looks at him and says, son, I thought I told you if you keep doing this, you'll go blind. Little Johnny stops and looks up at him and says, well, Daddy, can I do it till I need glasses? You know, and and that's a perfect description of me in the life. I'd see other people going, I'm just going to do it right, you know. Can't tell you the moment. Can't tell you the hour. Can't tell you where I was. Can't tell you what I was doing. Can't tell you who I was with when I crossed what we call that invisible line. I can tell you that I did, you know. Looking back on my experience, I can see some signs along the way that things were not working out too well for Ralph, and they're too numerous to name right now. Share some of the lowlights with you. Got married in 1980. Had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. I was getting married at 1 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon. I had a bachelor party that Friday night. Bunch of guys at the bachelor party, right? None of them are getting married but me. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. My ass is still at the bachelor party till 7:30. Me and my brothers. There's four of us in the program right now, right? They take me home, pour me in the bed at about 7:30, 7:45, get me up at 11 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm toe up. I ain't done nothing but laid on top of the bed. Right? I am toe up. And I get there, now I'm supposed to show up, and I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding, right? I wobble in there. My then-wife-to-be took one look at me wobbling in there. She looked at me. She looked at the preacher. She said, scratch the own vows. Say the regular on his ass. Right? So now my lines are cut to two words. So I get ready, you know. So it gets to me. I get ready to say I do. I say I threw up all over the hall. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Roger, Ryan, you guys might not be able to get with all of what we talk about at these podiums right now. If you're anything like me, came in new and you guys were sharing things like the psychic change and the phenomena of craving. You know, and I wasn't using these terms the way you guys use them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. So some of you old timers around here needed to help me with some of that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I live pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization over and over and over. I lived it up close and personal. See, because I need to let you guys know that that wedding day was the high point of that marriage. It went downhill after that. Because I'm the kind of father, and I'm the kind of husband, can remember sitting on my living room couch, my wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up. going to the dining room table, picking her purse up and clutching it real close as she walked back to the bathroom with it. And I would feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband can remember coming home and sticking the key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter sitting right here crying. Look over here and homeboy sitting in my chair with a gun pointed at my stomach saying, I want my money right now. I need to go with the men for just a moment. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I had a lot of doubts and I had a lot of fears when I was out there about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already gives you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas, laying up in bed night after night after night after night with a woman, knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you the one that's bringing the wolf to the door. See, my house got broken into four times. Four times I pretended to call 77th Division. But I was playing a game with myself because I knew what was happening, because they told me, you're going to give us our money or we coming up in there and getting it. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch. Two-year-old daughter coming outside pulling at my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. Stop, look up at her and give her a shitty grin and say, don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. I shared with you guys earlier that my disease is progressive in nature. And for me, it's progressive in a couple of areas. One area I already shared with you, that it takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. My disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. First time I went in my wife's purse, I thought long and hard about it before I did it because I don't steal from my family. Never have, never will. I borrowed $40 from her, and I told myself, I'm going to replace this money before she notices it's missing. Meant every word of it, because I don't take from my wife. You don't do that shit. Meant that. Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous saw me coming when they wrote it back in 1939 when it was published. There's a line in there that says, for reasons we don't even know about, alcoholic will be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation, weeks, even days ago. 2 weeks after I made that vow that I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing, I got paid again, and the same scenario presented itself. I'm out getting loaded. I need some money. My wife's not hiding the purse yet. I go back home, and the thought about giving money back that didn't even come to mind, and I didn't even deliberate and look at that purse a long time this time. Fact, I had a bright idea. I said the last time I hit this, I took the money from my wife. I took $40, spent it up, came back looking for the purse again, was so mortified about what I had done, I didn't look real hard. And I said, you know, this time, instead of taking $40 and having to go through that, this time I'll take all the money out, and that I don't spend, I'll sneak it back in the purse, right? And I was off and running, and I was going to my wife's purse on a regular basis. She started sleeping with the purse up under the pillow, and that wouldn't stop me. I could remember some of those nights, man, I'd be laying in the bed. And it's something about laying in the bed with that feeling on you, knowing the money's just an arm's length away. You know, and I'd be laying in the bed, and I'd wait on her to go to sleep. And I'd wait on that real regular breathing to set in. I'd let it set in for a while, crawl up my side of the bed, go over to her side of the bed, crawl up in there, and I come up under the pillow, and I come out real slow, put the purse in front of me, creep out the bedroom, creep out the living room, ease the front door closed, jump in the Volkswagen, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. It's Wednesday. Come back home Monday. Did that one too many Wednesdays, came back one Monday. Screen door was locked in the front. Screen door was locked in the back. Came back to the front, saw the note I missed the first time. The rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. Suitcases on the porch. I'm put out the house. I'm now my daddy. Went to go stay at my mother's house, and my disease really took off. I had five brothers, like I told you. Slowly but surely, all six of us ended up from our respective homes living back at our mother's house, and we almost killed her. She started bringing groceries home from work on a daily basis because she could not keep any in the house. And at that time, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man that she married. And she used to bring my two-year-old daughter over to the house on Saturday afternoons to keep a relationship with me. And I need to let you guys know that I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I wanted to be a daddy to my girl because I wasn't going to be like my daddy. I wanted to take my daughter to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to walk up the street to the store with her little hand in my big hand. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read her stories. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and give her a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get since I've been here. The look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons, man, was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. And I tell my mom, I'm going to the store to get Rain some ice cream. It'll be Saturday afternoon and I come back on Monday. I'd sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. And on those long Sunday nights, man, I'd be sticking my head around the side of my mom's house and I'd be crying. And through the tears, as those headlights were backing out the driveway, I'd see those two heads in those headlights and I'd be crying, saying to myself, there go my life backing out this driveway. I don't know about none of the rest of you guys. I've heard a lot of people share from podiums they were scared of dying out there. That ain't my story. I was never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old shit. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas. Over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I am so glad that God don't make misery comfortable. And on October the 11th in 1986, I got miserable enough and I got tired enough that I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. The Harbor Light Center in downtown Los Angeles on Skid Row. And on October the 13th, I went into that facility. And that night, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a speaker came in and shared his experience, strength, and hope. And he was standing up somewhat like I'm standing tonight. And when I went to that meeting, I was full of remorse, and I was full of guilt, and I was full of, I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done. You know, because when I shame in here, what I've shared with you guys is just the tip of the iceberg. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at mom's house. I started stealing out of mom's purse. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at mom's house. A check came to one of my little brothers in the name of R. White. All of us are R. White. Took that. Didn't share with you when grandmama gave me $200 for the family reunion in Atlanta. If it wasn't for my mom, she never would have saw Georgia. Didn't share with you the first time I tried to get sober. My ex-wife got me a job at a radio station, stole $1,600 from them, ruined her reputation in that industry. Didn't share with you guys a whole lot. Suffice it to say, I had a lot on my tip when I got here. And I was full of remorse and shame and guilt and fear, and I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I'd done. And a speaker was standing up in front of the group that night sharing his experience, strength, and hope. And he was sharing about taking from his family and sharing about taking from the job. And I remember thinking as I was looking and listening to him that night, and I was looking and thinking, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous shit, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that shit. You know. I'm different. I wasn't raised that way. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. Speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room, and he dropped this one on me. Just went straight to me, like I was the only person he was talking to. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. Caught my attention. He went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope at that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I went to. He described to me what I suffered from, and what I liked about him is he did it in the first person. He, for the first time, he wasn't talking about you. He talked about himself. He talked about himself and seemed like he just invited me in. You don't have to take my word for it. You know, he shared that I suffer from a disease that's physical in nature. That whenever I take one of anything, Ralph, check out your own experience. You ain't got to listen to me. When I take one of anything, no matter what I have to do, where I have to go, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my experience shows me my body takes over and I have to have another. Now, I ain't got to have a medical degree and understand why that happened. I really ain't got to try to get with the endorphins and the pleasures, and some of y'all been to programs and shit. I ain't got to get with that. You know, I like the way the book puts it. It explains things that have been unexplainable. If somebody in here is like Ralph and is baffled about why I did the shit I did, my wife used to look at me and say, God damn, how come you can't make it home with a dime out your check? And I'd close down and I'd withdraw and I'd be thinking behind my close down, how come I can't make it home with a dime out your check? Explain things that have been unexplainable. So when I said, I'm just going, and he said, Ralph, how many times did you say I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times you say I'm just going to happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times you say I'm just going to stop off by my boys? I got hours. What happened? Hope it, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? Every 2 weeks from 1979, 1985. Whole paycheck. I can't drink because of my body. Okay, Ralph, smart guy. How do you explain stone sober my car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday? Second part of this disease. Mental obsession. The obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered all those many years ago. I can't drink because of my body. I can't stop because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady, sometimes known as a soul sickness. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical are straightened up. And that's what we're in here talking about, ladies. If you're sitting in here right now, and a lot of times it gets twisted, it gets lost, and a lot of people put a lot on it, more than they have to be. People will call it the steps, the work, the process, the program. What is it where I really live? And Bill puts it in a way that I really like, what it is that we're doing in this room right now. He calls it a manner of living that really works. A manner of living that really works. If you're sitting in this room right now and you think this program is just about not drinking and just about not using, shortchanging the program and you shortchanging yourself. I ain't got nothing against physical sobriety. Don't get me wrong. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it home with a whole paycheck. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might not beat up on your old lady this weekend. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you'll probably make it to work on Monday morning. But what this program has to offer is so much more than that. In step one, it talks about admitting I'm powerless. It says nothing about accepting powerlessness. In fact, a little bit later, it says lack of power is what? Ooh, somebody read that book. Lack of power is my dilemma. Talk to me, Ralph. What? Not having power is my problem. Step one, a conclusion I draw based on my experience. What's my solution? Step two, I need some power. It's also a conclusion I draw based on my experience. Came to believe a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understood him. First thing I said to my sponsor when I got to that step, how I'm going to turn my will and life to go over to God as I understand. I don't understand him. Said, ain't but two things you need to know about God in order to get on this path. Number one, he is. Number two, he ain't you. That's more than enough to begin. And from that beginning, all sorts of remarkable things have happened in my life. Steps one and two are conclusions I draw based on my experience. Step one is the problem. Step two is the solution. 3 through 12, the 10-step program of action to get me to that solution. And I ain't got to worry about turning over my will and my life. If I submit to the rest of them steps, the steps are turn over the will in my life. You know, I am one of these people that, man, I get jazzed up about the process of recovery. I do a lot of talking about the program of recovery. I do a lot of talking about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I do a lot of talking about this power that's been introduced to me through this big process. And a lot of people will get it twisted. A lot of people will sit out there right now and think to themselves, damn, I want to be able to stand up and share my experience like this guy is. He must be working a hell of a program. Somebody else will get it on the other tip and will be thinking to themselves, I can never get up in front of people and share like that. Will I be able to have this thing? Check this out. What I'm doing right now, ain't got a whole lot to do with the program recovery. The ability to share about the program of recovery ain't got a whole lot to do with the ability to live this program of recovery. It's a living program, man, and it's within the grasp and it's within the reach of anybody in this room. That's what I like so much about this power you guys introduced me to that October in 1986, because I came up in here at 33 years old and I was toe up, man, and I had given up on life. It had been a long time since I had answered an 8 o'clock call to go to work for anybody's job, and I didn't think I would be employable anymore. I was 33 years old, and I wasn't welcome in nobody's house. I was sleeping in that. I'm a graduate of a major university in this country, and my job at the end of my drinking and using was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old, hoping he'd give me something to carry me through the night. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage. I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the men and women in this program and the men and women in this fellowship nursed me and loved me back to health. You grew me up. You said, let us love you till you can love yourself. And I said, you lying. I stink. If you turn your back on me, I'm liable to go up in your purse. How you gonna tell me you'll love me? And that was before I knew what takes place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was before I knew what happens when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we specialize in loving unlovable people. And you nursed me, and you loved me back to hell. You gave me a way out upon which we all agree, man. I'm one of these people that does a lot of talking about service work in this program. I'm one of these people that gets the opportunity to work with a lot of men and women in this program. I'm not one of these don't people. Don't go around these kind of places. Don't go around these kind of people. Don't get in these kind of relationships. Don't do this. Don't do that. Do read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, for somebody who has working knowledge and experience with that book. Do get a sponsor who has working knowledge and experience with the 12 steps of recovery. Do go to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do work with another alcoholic. Do apply the steps to the best of your ability to your life right where you are right now. Do get in touch with a God of your understanding and then do whatever the hell you want to do. This program is about living. It ain't about losing. And that's been my experience, man. Join us on the broad highway. I'm one of these people. You know, October the 11th and 19th, on October the 13th, this day, 16 years ago, a scared little boy posing as a man, 33 years old, clothed in clothes from the clothing room at the Harbor Light Center in downtown Los Angeles, sat in here like some of our new friends are sitting in here right now, Ryan, Roger, Catalina, Rhonda, and John. And they told me, "We know what you were thinking. I'm jittery and alone. I can't do this. But you can. You have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And to duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor." And they wrapped their arms around me 16 years ago. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that the men and women in this fellowship kept the light on for a broke down piece of somebody like me. I don't know how many of you walk the walk I walk, that walk of the living dead. I don't know how many of you come from the place I come from, that place of pain, that place of no hope, that place of being worthless, that place of being useless, that place of being of no value to nobody. And you guys gave me something. And 90 days of recovery. You guys allowed me the privilege of going out on panels. And I jumped at it. At the time, I thought, ooh, I had so much to say, and they want to hear what I got to say. I didn't know how bad we'd be looking for people to go on panels. And I started going out on panels. And every time I come back from one of those meetings, my head would be up a little bit more. Because it had been a long time since I had shared anything with anybody. I started going to meetings and I got a home group and I started sitting in the front. Men and women started hugging me and they started knowing my name. The way I got my sponsor, and I'm going to get out of here. I don't know where I'm going. The way I got my sponsor, because there's a lot of people in here who've been doing this thing. And sometimes we think it's the power of the message at this podium. We think this thing is about the transmission of knowledge and information, and that's not what it's about at all. I sat at a meeting one night, and the guy I had seen and admired, because everybody in AA knew him, and they knew him by name, and he seemed like a big, you know how when you knew, you see people around, and you'd be like, in all of them, and he threw down a piece, and he knew, and at the break, like we had a break today, he saw me sitting in there feeling alone and jittery and by myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he walked over to me, instead of just meeting with the people that he knows already like we do at breaks. And he walked over to me and he shook my hand and said, "Brother, my name is Bob Hunt. What's your name?" And I told him my name. And the speaker spoke, and I can't tell you what the speaker shared that night. I can't tell you anything that happened that night at that meeting but one thing. At the end of that meeting that guy was leading, he said after, you know, he had called somebody up to read a vision for you. And he said after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, "I want my new friend, Ralph, to lead us in a prayer." And somebody knew my name. Somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous knew my name. And I claim this safe place is my home. 9 years ago, another woman asked me to walk down the aisle with her and share life on this path again. I got all the way down the aisle this time. I got the I do out. I even have pictures to prove it. Before I left tonight, a little seven-year-old girl, I'm a seven-year-old now, gave me a kiss. Daddy, you going to a meeting? And she knows Daddy will be home. Because this seven-year-old girl has never seen Daddy not come home. This seven-year-old girl has never seen Daddy not provide. This seven-year-old girl has never had the fear of when he go, when is he coming back. That two-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in, she's 19 years old now. She's a sophomore at UCLA. 2 years ago, she went to a debutante ball. And she stood up there in a formal gown. I never thought my girl wanted to do this. And she was in her formal gown. And then she was walking out, and people were tuxedoed, and it was a big affair. And my girl walked, and she looked radiant, and she walked down the aisle. And they introduced her to society. And they said, presenting tonight, Miss Rain Javon White, escorted by not her uncle, not her stepdad, not her brother, not a cousin, not a play daddy, escorted tonight by her father, Mr. Ralph Alonzo White. And my little girl in her formal, all a big girl now, turned and curtsied to Daddy and took my arm, and I got the look. Like, this is my daddy. This is my hero. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I always wanted to be somebody important. I always wanted to do something special with my life. And I can think of nothing more important and nothing more significant than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am very aware of why it is I'm sober. You never hear me say, I don't know why I'm sober. Know exactly why. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph. I am an alcoholic.
Wow. Thank you so much, Ralph. Could you please have one more round of applause for him? After a moment of silent meditation for the alcoholic who still suffers in narrow these rooms, would you please join me in the serenity prayer?